Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
To inform, inspire, and empower Alcoholics Anonymous sponsorship, locally and internationally, to be their very best, both personally and spiritually. This is the mission of rumradio.org, an internet radio program dedicated to carrying the message of recovery to a world plagued by alcoholism and addiction. Alcoholism and addiction is the number one health issue in our world today, and rumradio.org is actively participating in the solution. Interviews with a plethora of people sharing their experience, strength, and hope. Live Sundays at 9 p.m. Central Time and rewound again on Saturday and Monday. Tune into 12-Stepology at its best on rumradio.org.
Welcome and hello, and thank you, Claire. That's my granddaughter, Claire. She's 9 years old. She's the only one in the audience. She took my mom's slot. One person. Can you imagine that enthusiasm? Thank you, honey. It's time for your bed. Papa really, really loves you. Thanks for the support. Well, this is Joseph G. with Rum Radio and rumradio.org, the most comprehensive 12-step sponsorship in the known and the unknown universe. Did you know that they discovered a whole new and different universe? Did you know that? I was so excited when I heard that.
Yeah.
Not a galaxy. Did you hear? You heard that? As soon as I heard that there was a whole different universe, the first thing I did is I went out and I applied for the position of center. I might not be much, but I'm all I think about. I'd like to acknowledge WNAH, that's Hoyt Carter and Tony the Horse, who affords us the opportunity to broadcast live to their listening audience in Nashville, down home at Nashville, parts of Kentucky, and sweet home Alabama. And they do this as a public service presentation. And they do this, you're going to like the price, free of charge, because they believe in what we're doing. We believe in what we're doing, and we want you to believe in what we're doing. And so now, I believe. We also like to acknowledge RecoveryToday.net magazine. It's one of the finer recovery journals, and they afford us some print space from time to time. I gratefully like to acknowledge my co-host, Harold B. He's a family intervention specialist, and he does a fine work with troubled families, and I personally believe the families are the basic unit of our society. And as the family goes, so does the country, so does the nation, and so does the world. We have found that most of the problems we have with alcohol and drugs today are from the children who, the latchkey kids, the children who grew up without parental supervision, who were not taught correct principles. You know, once you teach a child correct principles, they can teach themselves. But unless those principles are given, it's kind of a crapshoot, folks. Kids are going to band together like empty lot weed kids. The gangs, the groups, the clubs, they gather together without any parental supervision. They teach themselves. It's a sad state of affairs, but that's what happens. So we have that problem. We have an epidemic proportion of drugs and alcohol. Folks have no idea. According to Google, you know Google, 1,000 years hence, the anthropologists will have concluded that as a society, they all commune with an all-knowing God named Google. And according to Google, there's 140 million drunks in the world. Wow. That's a lot of folks. I don't know how they did. I don't know if they went from person to person. Excuse me, are you a drunk? Oh, yeah, okay, two, three. But that's the estimate. I take it it's a guesstimation, but that's usually fairly pretty – it's pretty accurate. There's 2 million in the rooms of AA. I would guess maybe another million in NA and then the CA. Oh, and by the way, A, this is not AA. This is not – N.A. This is not C.A. This is Rum Radio and rumradio.org. We're more like Paranoids Anonymous. The only problem is nobody will tell you where you hold the meetings. And hopefully it won't be Narcoleptics Anonymous. You'll enjoy the show. We have a really interesting guest tonight. As you know, we do people of note because they have better jokes, and we also do the regular Joe because who can put a yardstick on a miracle? And most folks have gone through recovery and come out on the other side, believe it or not. It's a miracle that this happened. Before Bill W. and Dr. Bob got together with this program, most of the time, 95% of the time, I think, or 98% of the time, people would die, be incarcerated, or end up in an insane asylum because of drugs and alcohol, mostly alcohol. Alcohol, why mostly alcohol? Because it's the most available. Most alcoholics will do drugs. Some drug addicts don't do alcohol, but usually there's a hand-in-glove connection with them. I believe it's a twofold disease. Splitting that up does not do anyone any service. Harold also goes to the prisons, and we find in the prisons, most of the prisons are filled with drugs and alcohol, crimes of opportunity fueled by drugs and alcohol. So what's going on? How come? What's going on? It's a breakdown of the society, and this is working on itself. So what we do is we're like starfish throwers. A red tide comes in, and there's millions of starfish on the ocean, on the beach. And there's a fella out there, and he's picking up a starfish, and he's flinging it back into the ocean and back to life. And another guy comes down, and he says, "What are you doing?" He says, "Well, I'm trying to save a couple starfish." He says, "Look, there's millions of them. You'll never save them all." He says, "Look, I know I can't save them all, but I'll save the ones I can." And this is what we do at Rum Radio with starfish throwers, where if we save one guy, if we help one guy, well, then that's one guy more. And then he might save somebody, and that's two. And then two will get three. And so that's what we pray. That's what we hope. So tell us, how you doing tonight, Harold?
I'm doing great. It's nice to be here. It's nice to be in recovery. I don't know where I'd be if I hadn't found the 12 steps and found a sponsor and worked the steps. I probably wouldn't be alive. So I appreciate this opportunity to come on and teach about what sponsorship is all about and what in the steps is all about. We've got to set things straight and really let people know that just going to meetings is not enough. Just being sober is not enough. We've got to get at the deeper levels of the mind and the heart. So it's nice to be here. I just wanted to tell our listeners that this is not a money-making proposition. Rum Radio and rumradio.org, the website and the radio program, don't make money, they cost money. And Joseph, that's his way of giving back. He shoulders the cost of the web page and the radio program. So we're here in an effort to give back. We've received so much, we want to give back. There is a call-in number, 949-534-0621. The number is 949-534-0621. And in just a moment, I'll have the chat room open. You can go to rumradio.org, click on the word live in the upper right corner, and then that will take you to the radio program, Blog Talk Radio, and you can, on the right-hand side, you can find our chat room. So you can type in questions if you'd like. So, yes, I work with families. I work with kids. Mostly I work with parents that are kind of, their thinking is off track. Maybe their approach leaves something to be desired. And so I do work with kids, but it's a lot more effective if I can really affect some change with the parents and their approach with the kids. I like to teach parents to catch their kids being good and praise them. That's the foundation. Another principle that I use is to watch your children when you find something they really like, hold it back until they cooperate. Don't give them what they want until they have cooperated. That, in that way, set up a system where they are better prepared for the real world, because that's how the real world works. And parents, I recommend that you connect your kids' allowance to their grades, because that fits with the real world also. If you work extra hard, you can earn a bonus at your job. Most jobs can earn a bonus. And with the kids, if they work extra hard in school, they can earn a bonus, extra income from getting really good grades. So those are a couple of ideas that I teach all the time. And so I'm looking forward to hearing tonight's guest, and I'll turn things back over to you, Joseph.
Thank you, Harold. That's very nice of you. One thing I've come across was that something in Proverbs that says, money answereth all things. I said, gee, wait a minute, that doesn't sound like that would be in the Bible, but it does. It says, a feast is made for laughter, and wine maketh merry, but money answereth all things. And you know what I realized, Harold?
What?
Never underestimate the value of a cash bribe.
Well, I don't allow the parents to call it a bribe. A bribe is money for doing something wrong, and these parents are rewarding their kids for doing something right, getting good grades. So no fair using the word bribe.
Okay. What if you bribe them to do something good? Anyway,
it's not a bribe,
okay.
It's
so,
a reward.
A reward, okay. Tonight's guest, see, I didn't see host. Tonight's guest is a man of note, a hip hop artist. His name goes by Mo Betta or Betta. In the big book, it says we're looking. What is that something better? And so we're going to do that. We're going to do the better tonight. How you doing, Betta?
How you doing?
Yeah, real good. If you just hold on for a little, just for a moment, we'd like to start off with how it works. How it works is found in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I like using the big book because it's the original template of all 12-step programs. Every 12-step program that is on the planet today comes from the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Bill W. came up with it. Now, we have variations, different understandings. AA will say you can use variations of the 12 steps as long as, it's agreement. I don't know if they would even enforce it, but the agreement is as long as the original 12 steps are made available. You can use any other variation you want as long as people could see what the original looks like. And I like the original on things. I like the original template. I want to see exactly what it looked like before it was changed. Then I know, Mark Twain would say, know it exactly as it is, and then you can change it up at will. Then you know how to change a thing. So this is how it works from Chapter 5, page 58. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program, usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. They're such unfortunates. They're not at fault. They seem to have been blonde that way. It's born, but I like the word blonde. They're naturally blonde. They're naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. Darn. Their chances are less than average. There are those, too, who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders. but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we're like now. If you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you are ready to take certain steps. At some of these, we balked. We thought we could find an easier, softer way, but we could not. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil until we let go, absolutely. Remember that we deal with alcohol, cunning, baffling, and powerful. Without help, it is too much for us. But there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Half measures availed us nothing. We stood at the turning point. We asked his protection and care with complete abandon. Here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. One, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Seven, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. Eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10. Continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11. Saw through prayer and meditation. I like to say prayer and medication. That's the old way. It used to be a lot of prayer. That would be the 9/11 prayer. God, please help me get me out of this jam. And medication to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for the knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. And 12, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Many of us exclaimed, what an order. I can't go through with it. Do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We are not saints. The point is, we're willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we have set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. Our description of the alcoholic, the chapters of the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after make clear three pertinent ideas. A, that we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. B, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. And C, that God could and would if he were sought. That said, in almost every meeting of AA, after about 5 years in the program, I turned around and I said to my sponsor, I says, hey, do we have to do that every meeting? I've heard it 1,000 times. He said, Joseph, it's still all about you. It's said for the new guy, the guy that never heard it before, and a reminder of what is needed. Remember, it's not so much what we forget, it's what we fail to remember. So, Beta, tell us, what was it like?
Very dark. First of all, I want to thank God for the privilege and the honor of being on your show. And second of all, I want to thank you and your co-host and the rest of the team at rumradio.org for inviting me. I take it very, very personal. Whenever I get to do something of this magnitude, and I want to you know, just thank you for that, for the opportunity. Yeah, so what was it like? It was very dark for me. You know, I come from a, you know, a very very dark past, you know what I'm saying? And
yeah, I was reading, you know, the your bio, but let's go back. Okay, when did you first, when did the first, was it alcohol, drugs that first rang your, you know, rang your bell, you know,
it
lit
was
you
alcohol.
Up? It was the first time. Alcohol.
It was
okay.
Alcohol, and I was about maybe, I don't know if I was about between 2 and 3 years old. First I need to say this, that I don't convict anybody of anything today. You know, so what I do want to say, though, is that I, you know, before I say anything, is that I love my father dearly, you know what I mean?
Yes.
But, you know, but when I was a kid, you know, when I was between 2 and 3 years old, the first time I ever tasted, you know, alcohol, I don't even remember tasting it. I just know that, you know, my dad casually put, you know, beer in my baby bottle, you know what I'm saying, and I tasted alcohol like that for the first time, unwillingly. So, like, you know, obviously, you know, my addiction took off, though, when I was about 8 years old, 9 years old. I drank for the first time willingly, and what had happened is that I ended up seeing, you know, my father and my uncle always drinking. They would go to the refrigerator and they would drink, and I knew that, you know, after they opened the refrigerator and they grabbed that cold can of beer that made that noise, a few minutes after that, or like an hour later, they were different. And so I tried it one time, and I felt different. And that's what, like, that's when, like, I knew that I can get outside of myself. So that was like the first time that I used, you know, willingly, was about 8 years old.
Yeah. Wow.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Okay. 8 years old. Wow. Three. That's pretty young. That's in your baby bottle. You sound like they do that with Germans. I don't know if you know that. It's fairly common in Germany, or used to be anyway. Babies would be given beer, you know, because the hops and the malt and all that, and it would keep the kid quiet. It has a lot of benefits to noisy kids. Oh, yeah.
And
you weren't German.
No, I'm not German. But, you know, I did, for some reason, and that's why, like, the music is very dear and near to my heart, because my father thought it was cool, you know what I mean, to, you know, to put beer in my baby bottle and then, like, watch me, you know, dance and stuff. So, like, you know what I mean? Like, so, you know, music has always been a part of my life, always, you know? So it kind of correlates to where I am now, you know?
Interesting. All right. So you're 8 years old, and you know what the sound of I take it they were pop tops back then, right? Pop top, they pop that top.
We from the hood, brother. You know what I mean? They were popping. You know, they were drinking cans. You know what I mean?
That's right.
They were drinking cans, tall boys, and you know what I mean? You know, the bottles were a little bit more expensive in the hood, but you know what I mean? I remember the can sound, you know, the you know?
Yes.
Yeah. And then, you know, and as men, you know what I mean, you know, everybody had something to prove. So I don't know, for some reason, I just always seen men drinking a can of beer and then, like, crushing it with their hands. I don't know what they was trying to prove, because, you know, I'm not trying to cut my hands today, you know what I mean? And, you know, but for some reason,
It's kind of interesting, because you were that young. I would imagine, and Harold, bear me out on this, since you're the professional, that would give him a sense of security of some kind, the sound of the beer and the cold and the whole reference. At 3 years old, I mean, the brain's still developing. That would give you a sense of community or security, doesn't it?
Yes, it becomes part of the daily routine, and kids really like daily routines. So it would be familiar and give him a sense of safety and security, yeah. Plus that warm feeling of the alcohol inside. But the problem is what it does to the developing brain. Now that we've got a lot of brain research, it's really an exciting time to be alive because of all they've discovered about the brain. And the brain doesn't finish developing until age 27. So anyway, go on with your story.
Sure. So that's the first time I ended up drinking willingly. But it was just like, you know, and like I said, you know, I love my, you know, I just want to reiterate that, I love my father dearly. You know what I mean? I understand today, you know what I mean, that, you know, they did the best they could with what they had. They weren't, you know, my dad wasn't as informed as we are privileged to be. And so, but, you know, growing up, he was a little strict with me, and, you know, I got punished a lot, and the ways that I got punished were a little tough at times, you know what I mean? But you know, what ended up happening to me was at the age of 11, going on 12 years old, I actually, I've done a little bit of work on, you know, a little bit of work on myself with a sponsor and some steps and, you know, and all that, and I do have a relationship with the higher power.
Let's rewind a little bit. Okay, so you're 8 years old, you're taking booze to school, you're drinking at home, what are you doing? How's that looking? You're drinking, you're 8 years old.
Well, no, not really. I didn't, you know, I wasn't really drinking. You know, I would do it occasionally. It wasn't like I was doing it daily. At 8 years old, when I did it willingly that first time, I just knew that there was something that I can run to if I ever chose to. I knew that I can drink something and I can feel different. I could feel, you know, because I, you know, at that age or by that age, I was already feeling like I had a body that didn't fit and a mind that I couldn't shake off. You know what I mean? And so,
right.
But I wasn't drinking. I wasn't getting, you know, I wasn't drinking at the time. I wasn't drinking to, you know.
Alcoholically, you know, you weren't drinking alcohol.
Yeah.
You knew you liked the beer, but you weren't an alcoholic at the So how long now? So you had regular school. You were living in the hood. When did you finally start really rolling around? When was the first time you started really getting into it? 10 years old, 12 years old, 15?
Well, and this is what I want to say. Like, you know, if I share something, you know, before I even keep on going, I just need to say that I try not to tell nobody how to work their program. I try to live by example. You know what I mean? I'm gonna share some things with you guys that, you know, is very intimate with me. But I think it's very important that people know that people can recover from these things. You know what I mean?
So
at the age of 11 years old, I was 11 going on about 12 years old, and I was raped by two men. And that took me, you know, like that right there, took me, you know, many years, you know, to get over. But what these two men brought in that room was an 11-year-old little boy. But I didn't get out of that room until I was rescued from my nightmare and came into recovery when I was 30 years old. You know what I mean? Because what came out of that room was a monster, you know what I mean? And so, like, you know, at 11, 12 years old, and that happened to me, I promised myself that, like, when I was graced to get out of that situation, I never told nobody that it happened, first of all. I felt, like, shame and guilt. And I felt like I was so defected on the inside that maybe them two men can see how defected I really was and can see through me and can tell that I was defected, and so maybe that's why that happened to me. And I didn't want nobody else, you know what I mean, to rape me in that way or abuse me in that way. So I never said nothing. And plus, like, growing up in a Latino culture, you know what I mean, like, you know, as a father with a lot of my cheesebone at the time in him, I couldn't go up to my father. I felt like I couldn't tell nobody because I was going to be looked at differently, or they might have, you know. And I'm not knocking anybody who's like, you know, gay, bisexual, or none of that. Like, I have a lot of people who are friends of mine who are, you know, who believe different things, and I invite them all into my life. I love them all. You know what I mean? But the reality is that I just didn't want people to think I was, homosexual, or that I was gay, or any of that. So I never told nobody. I just didn't want to be looked at as whatever people were going to look at me. And so I held it in. But what happened was that, you know, like I told you, an 11-year-old boy went into that room, and what got out of that room that afternoon was a monster. You know what I mean? And so I promised myself that I would never let nobody get close, because now, by this time, I identified, you know, because the people who did this were very close to the family, so close that we considered them family. So I identified, you know, love with pain. You know what I mean? And so, you know, I didn't want to let nobody in, because if they came close to me and they came close to my heart and there was love involved, I knew that there was going to be some form of pain attached to that, some shape, way, or form. You know what I mean? And so I just kept everybody at bay. And then it wasn't until about 13 years old, that I, I 13, 14 years old, I have to say, 13, 14 years old, I started, you know, I would drink every once in a while, and then I started smoking weed and all that stuff. But, you know, that's the time when I just promised myself that I was never going to let nobody disrespect me or violate me. And so I took to the guys on the corner. I took to some people that I knew from the neighborhood that were tough and I just got with them and we had each other's back, and that's when the whole gang stuff, you know, started happening. And, you know, and so I got down with this particular group of people, and we had each other's backs. But that's when really the lifestyle of like gang-banging and selling drugs, I mean, was just as addictive to me as using a particular substance. You know what I mean? I would get high off of knowing, or get drunk off of knowing that I can go to, you know, a basketball court with my crew and knowing that nobody was going to mess with me because I got, you know, 20 or 30 guys with me, and ain't nobody trying to say, and we young and we crazy, so ain't nobody really trying to say nothing, you know what I mean? And so I would get just as drunk or high, you know what I mean, off of the lifestyle, you know, of being, you know what I mean, in a gang, you know what I mean, and being a high-rising member, too. You know what I mean? That was another thing that, like, you know, at this time, you know, I didn't understand that I was a scared little boy trapped in a man's body. You know what I mean? You know, I didn't understand these things. So I was just trying to make a name for myself. And I would get drunk and high off of hurting people and putting fear in people. That's about the age that it really took off for me.
How old is this now? How old are you?
I'm about 14, 15 years old when this started happening. At this age also I started, I hope, you know, if there's anybody listening or even to you guys, I am not promoting or condoning a lifestyle. And I'm not trying to promote anything. This is my experience. This is my strength, and this is my hope. And sometimes, when I think back about the stuff I've done and the things that I've been through, I sometimes have wished that I didn't have the story I had. But this is my story, you know what I mean? And so, you know, my thing is that I ended up selling drugs, and at a young age, I sold drugs. I sold a lot of drugs, actually, and I was a young kid. You know what I mean? And this is just something that happens when you have people that have your back, when you have guns, when you have when you have crazy friends that are willing to stick up for you for nothing, no reason. when you can be 15, 16 years old and tell somebody to punch somebody in the face, I mean, and they ask you why, and you simply say, because I said so, and they do it because they know that if not, they're going to get in trouble themselves. Something happens when you have a little bit of power, and you have, like, you know, and you're living that kind of lifestyle. So I ended up,
sure.
Having a lot of, you know, a few people under me and stuff, and then we started getting into the drug dealing, and then we, you know, we locked down the corner, and we scared people off, and you know, we locked down a certain park. I will not mention certain names and certain neighborhoods and certain things that happened,
sure.
Because, you know, certain things that I'm not going to mention certain names, but I tell you that we terrified certain neighborhoods. We set up shop, and I was a little kid, man, making money, man, making lots of money. It was crazy, and so, you know, that led me to, you know, and there was a thing, like, every day we would hustle, we would sell drugs every day, and then at nighttime, you know, we would get dressed, and we would, you know, clean our cars. You know what I mean? And I was a little kid. I don't even think I had just got a license or whatever. But, I mean, granted, like, most of my friends didn't even have a license. We would just buy cars and ride around and look good. And every night we were playing pool somewhere, or we were at a club, or we were doing something. And we looked forward to that. And so that's, like, when it started happening for me, like, when I started getting lost in drinking and partying. And I would try to forget. I always try to forget that rape. I would always try to forget, the pain from, going through certain things as a child, and, you know what I mean, the punishments I used to receive and blah, blah, blah. And so, where I knew something was going wrong was when I was drinking a lot by the age of about 17, 18 years old. 16, 17, 18 years old, I was drinking a lot. I mean, I would wake up in the morning I would reach over and sip something to start my day. And as soon as I left the house, I was drinking. And on my way to school, me and some of my friends, would get together, and we would smoke weed, and we would get drunk. And by the time I got to school, I would notice how drunk, we would notice how drunk and high we were. And we didn't even walk into school. We would just go to somebody's house where, you know, our dads were or our parents weren't at, and we would throw parties, and we would get drunk and high all day, with the money that I was making, I didn't think it was a problem. I can look back and say, like, wow, there was a problem. You know, a teenager shouldn't wake up every morning and sip, you know, some E&J or Bacardi, or smoke weed on the way to school. Like, they should go to school and get an education and not get loaded or twisted on the way. But that was my story. Something happened to me, though, at the age of 19. Like, I ended up having a son. I had a son. Little Mo, if you're listening, I love you. My son is actually just turned 18 on February 24th. He was born February 24th, 1996. At this time, I started noticing, you know, that I needed to change. I would tell myself, like, I need to stop doing some things, but I just couldn't stop, like, drinking. Like, I knew at that time that I started having, like, I started processing, but I couldn't apply. You know what I mean? You know, I was informing myself at times. People would talk to me like, you know, you're drinking a lot. You know, I remember one time I bought a car. I bought a brand new Ford Taurus SHO. It was brand new. It was beautiful. I celebrated by leaving the dealership with a template on it. And I stopped by the liquor store, down south, y'all call it the package store. I stopped by a package store, and I bought a big bottle of Remy Martin, right? And I just twisted the cap, You know what I mean? And what we did in the hood was that we would tap the bottle and pour a little bit out, and, you know, for the people that ain't here, you know. And I remember just grabbing the bottle, and I was so happy because it was like, I think, if I'm not mistaken, I think that could have been the first time that I ever bought a car, you know, of the same, you know what I mean, you know, a brand-new car. And the thing is, like, I remember, like, I got that, you know, obviously I was selling drugs, so, I still celebrated. And I celebrated by twisting the cap of that bottle and drinking and not stopping until I was basically almost throwing up. And then when I was able to drink some more, I finished the bottle. So I put the car in drive. I lit a cigarette, and three blocks down, I ended up crashing the car, on this church lawn. I mean, like, I went over the curb.
Wow.
I went over the little wall. You know, I completely damaged the whole bottom of the car. It was a total loss. You know what I mean? And so, you know, so I knew that, you know, I had to stop doing. I just didn't know. I didn't know I had a problem. You know, a couple years after that, you know, by this time now I'm going in and out of prison. You know what I mean? I'm going in and out of jail. I'm fighting with people. You know, I'm going to nightclubs. I'm getting kicked out. People are dragging me out because I punched somebody in the face. You know, I don't know. For some reason, I always thought somebody was looking. You know what I mean? It seemed like I always had somebody to impress. You know, I was trying to be a legend. You know, and so, by this time, like I said, I was in and out of jail, and a couple of years after my son was born, me and my son's mother, we went our own way, and it just didn't work out. And I'm grateful for the mother that God gave my son, because, you know, she was able to be there for him in a way that I wasn't. You know, I was very absent, you know, going in and out of jail. And I mean, he knew who I was, and I contributed financially, but I just wasn't present, and I didn't have the spiritual muscle it took to disciple, to raise a kid, you know?
Sure.
But a couple of years after that, I ended up meeting somebody, and again, it was a quick relationship, but I ended up having a child, my daughter, Layla Marie, and, you know, the mother used to tell me, you're a great guy, you know, you got things going for you, but you party too much, and you know, and so at that time, you know, needless to say, I was selling heroin, and I ended up getting caught up, you know, like I started like sniffing heroin, and one day, you know, my daughter's mother, at the end of the pregnancy, you know, she wanted to go visit her mother in Jersey City. So I said, go ahead, we'll go visit your mother. And she's like, listen, you know what you need to do? You need to get right. Like, you know what I mean? So, you know, this baby's going to need you. You know, I'm going to need you. And, you know, you need to stop doing what you're doing. And she knew that I was up to something that was more than drinking and smoking weed. But I was kind of keeping it up still by that time. Like, you know what I mean? You know, I was, nobody really knew. But I was on, you know, I was slowly coming to a crack. Like, you know, that's like, you know, I went from balling to falling, like, that year. That's the year that, like, you know, that people were shocked at the things that I was doing, you know, because I wasn't, like, trying to make money no more. I was trying to, like, hide a feeling, and I couldn't understand exactly what it was. But on September 17th, September 17th, my life took, you know, a dramatic turn when my daughter, Layla Marie, died in my hands. And when my daughter, Layla, passed away in my hands, I could not believe the pain, you know what I mean, that attacked my heart, you know what I mean? It was just like, and I think about it, like, you know, today, and, you know, how I couldn't comprehend, you know, how you can love something so much and it be gone so fast, you know. And that was like the baby that was, you know, that was the situation I felt like, you know, I promised myself that, okay, you know, when she goes to Jersey City, you're going to go, you know what I mean, to detox, and you're going to come out, and you're going to be a father to that daughter, and that baby, you know, like, she was, like, my hope, right? And so 30 days later, when she died in my hands because of a kidney failure, I remember being at the funeral, like, you know, and I remember the coffin going down. And when she died, man, you know, when I seen that coffin go down, it was like half of my heart. It was like my whole heart, you know what I mean, got buried with her in that, you know, in that cemetery, you know. And like,
you know what they call that, Betty? You know what they call that? Is I was reading the scriptures one time, and I've had two daughters die, and it's called. And it was the phrase is, the pain was exquisite.
Yeah, exquisite. I felt
exquisite. Before I read that, before I knew what it meant, I didn't know what that meant. But when I had that, then I knew what exquisite pain felt like.
Sure. So yeah, so I felt that, you know, exquisite pain, and I just couldn't comprehend what was happening. I really couldn't, you know, and mind you, like, you know, my family grew up, you know, Roman Catholic, you know what I mean? They were Catholic, you know, my family believed that, but but the God that I serve, you know, here, you know, the God that I had heard of, right? Like, not that I serve, I didn't serve no God. If anything, I served the enemy very well for many years, you know what I mean? But the God that I had heard about, you know what I mean, he was very punishing, and I felt like I was being condemned to hell, being convicted to the hellfire way before I even knew what hellfire was. I just, you know, I just could not believe exactly whatever I was feeling. I felt was like hell on earth, and so I just, you know, that's when I went from not just drinking. But I knew that I can run to a substance to forget about what had just happened to me, you know, and so I started sniffing dope, and it was shortly after that I actually a friend of mine told me, well, not a friend, he wasn't a friend of mine, he was just an acquaintance from the environment he said, hey, listen, man, you're sniffing all that dope, you know, all that heroin. You know, if you take just a little bit of that and do it, you know, with a syringe or a needle, you know, you're going to get really messed up, and you're really going to forget about some stuff. And so I always told myself, you know, because I was that kind of guy that, you know, nobody expected, you know, ever expected that I would turn out to be, an addict, you know what I mean, addicted to drugs and stuff. Like, nobody, you know what I mean, and including myself. I was that kind of cat when I was selling drugs, you know, the kind of kid that would tell people, you know, yo, why are you doing it? Like, my friends, I would make sure, I would sell stuff to everybody else, but when it came to my friends, and if I found out that they was on drugs, I would, like, you know, I would yell at them, and, you know, I would convict them, you know, like, how can you do that? You know, and then, you know, things flipped for me, and I became the same exact guy that, you know, that I told other people not to be, you know what I mean? And so that's why it's very important for me today not to judge people about what they do. You know, my sponsor, you know, I want to give a shout-out real quick, man, to the man, you know what I mean, who has helped me, you know what I mean, become, you know, somewhat of a man, you know what I mean, today. You know, and this guy, Raymond R. from Brooklyn, New York, man, I really got to give that guy a shout-out, because that guy right there, he taught me so much. You know, he's taught me so much. I just felt like I needed to say that, man, because
sure.
You know,
let's rewind just a little bit. Okay, so you're down now. You're shooting up, heroin, right? And you've become the guy that you hate the most, that you despise the most. You become that man. All right, where's the bottom? Let's hear the bottom.
The bottom was the bottom was 2000 it was the bottom was kind of dragged out a little bit. But the day
aren't
of,
they
you
all?
Know, I mean, yeah, no doubt. But it was dragged out for me a little bit. I know that this is what happened to me at the bottom. The bottom was that one day I was it was snowing outside, and man, I get emotional thinking about this, man, Joseph. You know, I really do. And Harold, man, you know, this is healing for me. I remember one day walking through the streets, and so this guy came up to me, you know, and I, by this time I'm shooting dope and I'm smoking dust, you know, PCP, you know, I'm sniffing whatever I can do, I'm drinking whatever I can get, and I'm totally I was in a psychosis from the day of the funeral up to, you know, 2006. I don't remember much. But what I do remember is
wow.
Yeah, I don't remember much. I was a man on a death mission, you know what I mean? But what I do I can tell you is this, that I had started, you know, smoking dust along with you know, shooting dope, and I got locked up in May 11th of 2006 was the day that I believe that God rescued me, you know what I mean, and brought me to, you know, first, before he brought me to recovery, he sent me to jail, right? You know what I mean? And so,
right.
But when I went to jail, you know what I mean? And after they intake me and all that, and I got to the block, you know what I mean? In the jail where I was going to be at, some guy came up to me when it was chow time. You know, chow time means, you know, when we're going to go out to eat. And so, you know, so it was chow time, and we're on our way to the dinner hall. And this guy comes up to me and says, "Hey, man, I'm glad you're here." And I was like, "What are you talking about?" And he was like, "I'm really glad you're here." So I almost started a fight with him because I was like, "What you mean you're glad I'm in jail? Are you crazy? You shouldn't be glad nobody's in here, like, you know." And I almost, like, you know, kind of attacked him. And he said, "No, better, like, you know, like, slow down." He was like, "I'm just glad to see that you're alive, man." And I was like, "What are you talking about?" And so he explained to me that he had driven around my, because he was from my neighborhood. And he had driven around my neighborhood, and he had seen me, you know, like, standing in front of a tree in different spots in my neighborhood, knocking on the tree like if I was talking to a tree, right?
And I was like,
"What?" And he was like, "Yeah, man." And right at that moment, I had remembered that when I got locked up and when I was going through the intake process, I remember looking at my knuckles and my hands hurt. And I remember looking at my hands, And I remember having a lot of splinters in my knuckles, and I was thinking, what the hell? Like, how did I get all these splinters in my knuckles? Like, what happened? And so, you know, so what happened is that, you know, while I was in my psychosis, I guess that I remember, I mean, you know, I guess I remembered that growing up, I used to see the Keebler Elves commercial, you know what I mean? And
The
little Elves commercial. You know what I mean? Like, you know, they would bake their cookies and their brownies in the tree, and, like, in the commercials, they would come out, you know what I mean, with brownies and cookies. So by this time, I didn't want to go home drunk and high or whatever, because my father and my mother would get into arguments, and I didn't want to cause no trouble at the house, and my father always, you know, he would always have something to say and, you know, not even want me there because I was so twisted. And so I did, you know, so in order not to go to home and cause drama just to get a plate of food, what I would do is that I would stand in front of a tree and knock on the tree, and I would stay there for hours thinking that a little Keebler Elf would come out with a bag of cookies or something, you know what I'm saying? I mean, I can laugh about it now, you know what I mean?
You weren't laughing at the time. You were really waiting for that cookie.
I was waiting for cookies, brother. You know what I mean? And so, that was like really close to the end. You know what I mean? And Well, that, I mean, that was, you know, me knocking on trees was really close to the end, but, I mean, you know, that story really resonates with me. So, you know, but needless to say, I think it's safe to say that, you know, I got stories like that for days of bottoms after bottom after bottom after bottom. But I believe, right, I believe that I had to go through everything I had to go through to get to where I am now. You know what I mean? And so I could talk to you about my bottom, but I want to talk to you about, you know what I mean, like, you know, a rescue.
All right. Well, the reason why I ask you about the bottom is to say, okay, I hit my bottom. I was beaten into a state of reasonableness. Bill W. coined the phrase. The reasonableness means we're able to reason. That means we're teachable. Most alcoholics and addicts are not teachable because our egos are still too big. You can tell a drunk anything, you just can't tell them much. Until we're beaten into that state of reasonableness, nothing's going to happen. And what it usually takes, in my experience, is a bottom. And the bottom is different for different people. Some are really near-death experiences. Some the first time they've gone to jail have woken them up. But if you're really a tough, if you're real drunk and you're tough, and you're so tough that you're practically dead before you get great.
I mean, I wasn't practically dead. I overdosed. Like, and this is what I wanted to say to you. Like, I've had right before, you know, my clean day, my sobriety day, I had, you know, right before, you know, the day that I was born again, like, literally, is May 11th, 2006. But I could tell you, you know what I mean, like, you know, like, I had many bottoms at the end of the road. I had many, you know, I was shot at point blank range. You know what I mean? Thank God I'm still here. I overdosed 5 times. I flatlined 5 times. You know what I mean?
Wow.
I've caught frostbite on my feet from walking, you know, copping, being in the street, and needing and chasing that first one, you know, that next one. You know, so, I mean, I bottoms and bottoms, you know, I've been through a lot of disgusting animalistic stuff. Like, I understand, you know what I mean, like, you know, the bottom, you know what I mean? But I think my bottom is the day that I got locked up on May 11th, you know what I mean? You know, that's when I got locked up and it's my bottom and my rescue as well, because I remember when I got locked up and I got locked up for, you know, obviously I sold a little bit of drugs to somebody. I got locked up and so anyway, what ended up happening when I get to the precinct, I remember them telling me, the officers told me, you're too young to be like looking how you're looking, because by this time I'm not showering every day. I smelled, you know what I mean? I had a beard. I was looking rough, you know what I mean? I was looking how I was feeling, you know what I mean? And I remember when I got to the precinct, you know what I mean? The cops told me, hey, man, like, you look too young. You still, you know, like, if you take care of yourself, you look good. Like, you know, it seems like you're pretty, you know, you're an all right person. You seem like a good human being. And I remember just telling them, listen, man, I don't want to talk to you, police. Just put me in my cell. I know where I'm going anyway, and so I remember they took my shoes off, you know what I mean, and they threw me in the cell, and I remember when I walked into that cell and I felt relief. I felt like I didn't have to run no more, at least for a little while. I didn't have to run and be a slave to whatever it was I was running to. And whatever it is I was trying to buy to seek relief from. And I remember dropping to my knees. And at this time, I don't know about God. You know what I mean? Like I told you, I always ran from, you know, the kind of religion that was, like, kind of imposed on me growing up because, you know, it was punching and all. You know, so I hated whatever concept, you know, especially the misrepresentatives of God, you know, and all these people. And so I didn't know God. I've never known God until recovery, right? And so I walk into this cell, and I remember just feeling relief, and I dropped to my knees, and my first prayer, you know, clean and sober, was this: I don't know who you are up there, but I am asking you that you please help me, because I don't want to die a drunk, or a drug addict, and I know that my daughter is looking at me, and I'm asking you to please turn me into a halfway decent man, because I don't want her looking at me the way that I look at me when I look in the mirror. Amen. So that was my first prayer. That was my first prayer in sobriety and in recovery. And so, you know, they locked me up. I did a few months.
I call that the prayer of the agnostic.
Yes.
I've asked quite a few people about that. Oh yeah, it works every time. It's an evil and adulterous generation that seeks after signs. So the righteous don't usually don't ask. The atheist got nobody to talk to, so they're not going to ask. So it's really the agnostic is going to. And Bill W. read his story. He said the same thing. In other words, he said, if there is a God, show yourself. And this is what the agnostic says. Hey, I don't know if I'm talking to anybody, but if there's somebody there, I need to know.
Sure. And that was exactly, you know, I was a very hyper agnostic at that moment. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I was reaching, I was asking for help to a God that I didn't, you know.
You've heard that there was such a thing, but you had no relationship with this thing, that you had a word, you had an abstract concept. The other thing I was going to mention is that to live in fear is to know what it means to be a slave.
Yes, definitely. And I can totally identify with that, because my thing was that I was living in fear because I was scared to feel everything that I knew I had to feel. You know what I mean? And I was a slave to my feelings. You know what I mean? I was shackled,
right.
You know what I mean, into my trauma. And so, you know, I ended up, you know, getting locked. You know, I did a couple of months locked up, and I was able to, like, you know, I detoxed cold turkey, you know what I mean, in jail. And believe me, man, I went through about a month and a half, almost 2 months of kicking a heroin, you know, addiction, you know what I mean, in a jail cell. And, you know, no
That's
methadone,
rough.
No nothing, you know, nothing. And you know, all the guys from that I was locked up with would try to give me a lot of candy, you know, a lot of sugar, to put sweet, you know, sugar, you know, kind of helps out with the stomach and the sweetness, you know, helps out. But that was it. I mean,
alcohol is a sugar. Did you know that alcohol is a distilled sugar, liquid sugar?
Definitely.
So you take the alcohol away, the craving for sugar is unbelievable.
Oh, sure. Yeah, so I ended up, you know, getting paroled a couple of months after, and I got paroled to a place called the Salvation Army. And at that place, I was paroled there, and, you know, like, I really need to say this too, man, like, that place did wonders for me, because it, like, as soon as I went to court one day, and my lawyers were there, I was released, you know, that day. I went to court, and I ended up getting paroled to this facility, and, as soon as I got there, you know, I had no idea what recovery was. I thought recovery was, you know, you get shot, you get stabbed, you go to the hospital, you go to ICU for a couple of days, then you go home and you recover, right? So I thought that's it. I didn't know nothing about recovery. AA, NA, CA, OA. All I knew was DEA. And FBI and CIA, like, I had no idea of nothing, you know what I mean? Like, AAs and anonymous.
Yeah.
Actually, you know, in the hood, that's a scary word, anonymous. Like, you know what I mean? Like, you know, I didn't know nothing about anything anonymous, anything recovery, you know. And so as soon as I get to this facility, I'm there with both my lawyers, and my lawyer says, they're calling you. So I go inside the place, and they say, listen, I know you just got here, but you have to do a mandatory meeting. And I said, what? And they said, yeah, you have to go right out the gate and go to the right, and there's a meeting right there attached to this facility is a building, and they have a meeting there. And I said, okay, so, you know, I mean, whatever, I'll do it. So my lawyer said, listen, you know, your family's on your way with your clothes. Here's a little bit of money. I'll come by and visit you sometime soon, whether tomorrow or the next day. How you doing? So I went, I'm walking over to this meeting, and some guy, I didn't know, see, because I can't, I'm going to be real with you, you know what I mean? Like, I thought that all you people in, you know, when I first came to the meeting, like, this guy who I have it to be understood was a greeter, right? I didn't know about greeters. So this guy tries walking up to me and give me a hug and welcome me into the meeting. And where I come from, men don't hug, right? So he tried hugging me. And what I did was that I pushed him, and I sent him flying. And his literature went flying in the air. And all the home group members of that meeting ran towards me and tried to, like, calm me down. And I remember saying, you know, to him, like, what's your problem? I'm a man. You know what I mean? You don't hug men. I don't know you. I just, you know, don't you know who I am? And he looks at me. He's on the floor, and he's looking at me, and he looks up to me on the floor with all his literature all over him, and he looks at me and says, and this is when I knew that something was weird, right? Weird, not good or weird. I said, he said, welcome. Please stay here. Don't leave until the miracle happens. And I looked at him. I mean, what can you say to that? You know what I mean? You know,
not much.
And so, not much. And so this guy comes up to me and says, "Hey, listen, brother. This guy is a greeter. That's his position, is to greet people. He probably took, you know what I mean, a liking to you because he's seen that you got your prison uniform on still, and he probably just wanted to welcome you in." And I was like, I felt so embarrassed, and I knew that I needed that place because I didn't know how to live. By then, I didn't know how to live, you know what I mean? You know, with or without, you know, drugs and alcohol, I just didn't know how to live. And so, you know, so that was my first experience of going to a recovery meeting, you know what I mean? And it was an AA meeting. And so, you know, and I just sat in the meetings, man. And you know what they told me? They told me, you know, go sit down. We welcome you anyway. And I sat down. I couldn't believe these people let me in because nobody let me in nothing at the end of the road. And the guy actually, this guy must have been an angel. He actually made me a cup of coffee and brought it to me after I pushed him.
Wow.
I was just baffled. I was baffled by the whole thing. You know what I mean? And he turned out to be a really good friend of mine. I was just like, wow, I couldn't believe, you know, what had happened. And so I started coming around.
Yeah, and we've all been there, too.
Yeah. No doubt. And, you know, I started coming around I've done everything wrong. And that's what I also want whoever's listening, or if there is anybody, you know what I mean, who, you know, maybe even, like, I don't claim to have had, my recovery hasn't been great. Like, at the beginning, since I got here, you know, since I got rescued May 11th of 2006 up to present day, I've done many things wrong, even in recovery. Like, you know, I got with people I wasn't supposed to get with. I got with newcomers. I was disgusting. I sold drugs, you know, in recovery. I've done everything wrong. I've done H&I commitments, you know what I mean, with drugs in my pocket. I mean, I was crazy. I just didn't know how to let the lifestyle go, you know what I mean? And it wasn't until about a year and a half, you know what I mean, when I started doing, like, work, you know, when I got involved in sponsorship. You know what I mean? And that's why I mentioned that, you know, my sponsor's name, you know, Raymond R. from Brooklyn, because this guy...
When did you meet him?
In Brooklyn.
Better. When did you
Brooklyn.
Meet Raymond? When was this guy? Okay, this is... After prison?
Yes, this was after. This is where, like, I was given a recovery CD to listen to, and it was two people. You know what I mean? My friend said, "Listen, you need to listen to these things. I think you'll like them." And the first CD that I ever got was of my sponsor, Raymond. And so I remember I said, "All right, I'm going to listen to somebody talk about their story, about their life, whatever. I've heard it all. Ain't nobody can tell me nothing. And I mean, I should just fling this, right?" But I didn't fling it, and I went home and I listened to it, and I swear to you that when I heard that CD, I heard God through a speaker. You know, everything he was saying,
yes.
You know, everything he was talking about, I felt like he was talking to me personally. You know what I mean? And then, you know,
yes.
I talked to some people, you know what I mean? I chased them down, you know what I mean? And I got his number, and at that time, you know, I needed a sponsor at that time, and at that time, I knew that I had to talk to somebody about who I thought I was, you know what I mean? And I needed to, like, take my, you know, my recovery more serious. So, you know, so anyway, we got involved in a relationship, and I tell you, I stopped, you know, selling drugs in recovery.
Did you start working the steps when you got together? Did you go right into the steps, or was it more difficult?
Oh yeah, definitely. No, definitely. My sponsor told me. I asked him, when can I start doing steps? He said immediately. I said immediately. Okay. We can't build on a relationship first. How soon do you want to recover? I said soon.
Yeah.
I said, it's life and death for me. He said, exactly. He said, we're going to start doing steps immediately. I said, okay. You know, so he would give me assignments, and he would, but he always had me working steps, you know what I mean? But it wasn't until I did the steps one time, and it was like, you know, I didn't really want to share exactly, I mean, where I was at, but it wasn't until, like, the second time that I did the steps, maybe with him, that I really started peeling the onion back, and I started being real, because before I started writing on my first step, the second time, he said, I don't want you to tell me what you think I want to hear. He said, I want to hear about the stuff that's in your closet. You know, that stuff that,
yeah.
You know, that plays peekaboo
with
you.
The
secret,
the sick secrets. You're sick as your secrets. We want to know
point.
The secrets.
Yes. And so,
point.
Yeah, so, And so at that time, my first third step, you know what I mean? I got, because I used to use my daughter as a higher power, and then I used to use, GOD, group of drunks, you know what I mean? Or group of druggies, whatever, you know what I mean? The great outdoors. But I got to a place, man, just going to meetings and listening to other people and watching people transform, you know, being, you know, watching people being, you know, the second step, you know, the tangible evidence in my vision, I was seeing people being transformed that were doing the work. And I said, that's the stuff I need to do. You know what I mean? And so, I got to this third step, and I knew that I needed to come to believe, but I knew that I needed to turn my life over to something. You know what I mean? And that was real. That was, you know what I mean? And so I started investigating, and one day, at a church in Brooklyn, my sponsor is also a pastor, so he was preaching, and he told me, listen, why don't you just come visit, check it out. If this is your thing, cool. If it's not, because one thing I love about my sponsor is that he's never shoved anything down my throat. He's always allowed me to have my own experience, and my own judgment, but he's also given me his wisdom and experience as well. So he invited me to this church where he was preaching at, and as he's preaching, I'm watching him, you know what I mean? And they invited me to the front row, I'm sitting in the front row of this church, and he's preaching, and everything he's talking about, I felt like as I'm looking at him, he transformed into something else, and I couldn't even really see his face. It was just something like soft and beautiful, and everything that he was speaking was piercing my heart, and it was just breaking me down, and I felt, you know what I mean, at the altar call, right before, you know, I thought, you know, like, they called, they said, you know, if anybody wants to receive, you know, the Lord Jesus Christ right now, I mean, you know, please come up to the altar call. And I remember something saying to me, it's time. I'm here. I've always been
interesting.
Here. And as soon as I walked up to the altar call, I felt like my knees literally, I remember hitting my knees, and I remember feeling that I felt a warmth in my chest that I'd never in my life experienced, which I have it to believe today was, you know, the Holy Spirit
bosom. You had a burning in the bosom.
Yeah, man, it was beautiful. And I've never been the same. Granted, we go through, you know, just because, you know, we come to recovery and you know, we get a God, and, you know, I like to live in the real world, you know what I mean? So, you know what I mean, my reality and my experience is that life didn't become perfect, but it became perfect. I don't know if you can, you know, understand, you know, I just, everything just seemed like...
It was
like,
perfect for you.
It was perfect for me. It was perfect for me. I felt like, you know, I finally felt loved is exactly what I felt. I finally felt comfortable, you know. I finally found, you know, people, I mean, that felt the same thing and wanted to help me grow in it. And so, you know, June 27th, 2010 is actually when I accepted the Lord in my life, and my life hasn't been the same ever since. It really hasn't. I mean, I've gone through, you know, a relationship, and I've gone through a marriage that didn't work out, and I have a little son as well. You know, going to be 3 years old this year, named Elijah, you know, that came out of that failed marriage. But the reality is that regardless of whatever has happened, you know what I mean, I understand, you know what I mean, that everything, you know, and for me, my experience, for me, that everything that has happened in my life up to this point, I mean, had to happen for me to be the man I am today. You know what I mean? And so today I understand for me that, I'm just exactly where I'm at. You know? I'm okay with that.
I mean,
you know?
Yeah, yeah. No, that's great. You're exactly where you're supposed to be, and we understand that in the program. Time takes time. Everybody's on a different path. Do you do any sponsorship yourself? Are you a sponsor?
Oh, sure. I sponsor a lot of guys. I have sponsees in Brooklyn. I got sponsees in Manhattan, in the Bronx. I got sponsees in Queens. I actually have.
If you say Staten Island, I'm gonna. If you say Staten Island, I'm gonna go into a song.
Oh, actually, I actually think I do have a couple of sponsors in Staten Island.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, I know that my sponsors cover all the whole tri-state area, Jersey. No, for real, I really mean
the
this.
Five boroughs. We cover the five boroughs, baby.
So I also sponsor about nine guys in Rhode Island, right atop of New York, in Rhode Island. I have three guys that I work with from Florida. You know, we do the video chat thing. I actually have one in L.A. Who's in prison. that I haven't talked to in a while, but you know, we do keep in touch. So yeah, I sponsor many men. I believe that the program is in our literature. I also believe very, 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 very heavily in sponsorship. I was taught that sponsorship is the heartbeat of the program.
Amen.
And so, you know, it's the vital line that, you know, it's who we pass the baton on. And so, yeah, I take sponsorship very seriously. Actually, I'm every day with a sponsee. I hang with my sponsees when I or either, you know, some of my sponsees share, because we get asked to carry the message a lot. You know, we all get together and we roll out and we support each other and we go out of town together. We go to conventions together. We eat together. We pray together. We go to meetings together. It's just amazing for me. Sponsorship is very sacred. It's like sponsorship in recovery for me is like mentorship, you know, being, you know, and you know, in my church for me. You know what I mean? Like, you know,
right.
I have a home church. I got a home group. You know what I mean? I have a pastor. I got a sponsor. I got people to disciple. You know, discipleship, sponsorship. Evangelizing, carrying the message. Like, you know what I mean? It's pretty easy for me when it comes to that, you know? Because I was also, when I accepted the Lord in 2010, as soon as I accepted the Lord, I had questions. So I started going to the New York School of the Bible, and I went to New York School of the Bible for a little bit over two years, and I studied theology.
You're breaking up. Can you hear him? Are you breaking up too, or am I breaking up? I'm breaking up. I can't hear anybody. All right, I'm going to click off and click back on.
Here, let me check our electronics. Yeah, we're still on the air, so I might be the only one. Let me look here. So he also said, Harold, did you notice that? But every time you were in big trouble, there was drinking or drugs involved. And I began to connect the dots, and that really helped me a lot also. These days I don't use the word alcoholic. It's so overused, it's lost its meaning. But I do realize that not every time I drank did I get in trouble, but every time I was in trouble, there was alcohol and drugs involved.
I think we're back.
Hello? There you are. There you're back. I hear you now. Joseph, can you hear me?
Yeah. I think there's a problem with the board. You there, Beta?
I'm right here.
You know, we're almost out of time, and before we go any further, I wanted to play your song. I'm sorry about that.
Oh,
there
sure?
was a technical difficulty on the board, so... but I think we got the gist of it. So let's. I want to play your music. Is that all right?
Oh, Joseph.
Sure.
Joseph.
Yeah. Okay.
Can you hear me, Joseph?
Yeah.
Mo better life. ENT. Raw Island. Brooklyn, stand up. Going to the top, baby. When I'm alone in myself, sometimes I sit and I dwell, thinking how I made the fall, but all I know is that I fell, feeling like I'm in hell, but I won't snitch, won't tell. All I think about is my family, hoping that they're all well. There I was, son, standing on the corner alone, till my man, I got a call on my cellular phone. I got connections that keep my cells running on roam. Locked behind walls, meditate in the zone. Incarcerated, COs have me feeling all stressed. Can't see my little son feeling like some mess. Don't wanna be another number in the world of this pain. So for now, we snatching props in this hip-hop game. I got plans to take all these drug dealers' grams, make grands, and hold the world in the palm of my hands. But for now, it's just a dream for me to have back green. Premeditating on my moves till I get back on the scene.
Got change to breathe life into the light. Resurrection of hip-hop from darkness to light.
Got change to breathe life into the mic. Resurrection of hip-hop from darkness to light.
Got change to breathe life into the mic. Resurrection of hip-hop from darkness to light.
Got change to breathe life into the mic. Resurrection of hip-hop from darkness to light.
When I'm alone in my shell, I zone out. I can't tell whether or not I'm thinking clearly, dreaming how to excel. When there's so many obstacles on my path, I hold fast, clench my fist when I think somebody gripped me at last, and then release before I unleash the beast that's within me. When I feel I can't breathe, inhale, then I'm exhaling hip-hop. Resurrect the culture that don't pop, and let the life rock. Steady crew, Zulu, I thought you knew, but you're too far gone to even have a clue. Can't you sabe, mix them by DJ Clue, Tony Toka, or Executioner's Crew. We sick of stripper music, glorifying money like it's valuable, without peace of mind like the specs don't suit. The warrior, you wouldn't understand, cause we're plagued by assassins like puppets in the hand.
God save to breathe life into the mic. Resurrection of hip hop from darkness to light.
God save to breathe life into the mic. Resurrection of hip hop from darkness to light.
God save to breathe life into the mic. Resurrect hip hop from darkness to light. Won't leave it to nobody else but me. Nope, the big homie better. Better life, BNT. No sir, hip-hop is not dead. Better got a message aiming for your head. About to change the game when I tell my story. How a thug goes from banging to the glory. Straight from the bottom, so my journey was hard. Heading to the top, for glory goes to God. So grateful that the bullets didn't stop me. Died 5 times, woke up and said, not me. Got a new direction in my mind for sure. Better life is coming, founder's name is Mo. Tired of hearing the same old fame. Better's putting the message back into the game.
Got change to breathe life into the mic. Resurrection of hip-hop from darkness to light.
Got change to breathe life into the mic. Resurrection of hip-hop from darkness to light.
Got change to breathe life into the mic. Resurrection of hip-hop from darkness to light.
Got change to breathe life into the mic. Resurrection of hip-hop from darkness to light.
Thank you.
Ta-da. That was really good. I got to tell you, I'm not usually into hip-hop, but I really like that. Matter of fact, while I was listening to it, my pants dropped below my hips.
Hey, listen, I want
to... Now I'm going to have to wear my ball cap to the side. I'm going to have to get gold chains.
Yeah, I got you, baby boy. I'll send you something. Don't worry about it. We'll have you looking like Jay-Z next week.
We better close up. We're almost out of time. Thank you so much. That was great. I enjoyed it. Great show. Thanks again. Thanks,
thank
Harold.
Thank you. God bless.
Thank you.
You're
in
welcome.
Closing, I'd like to say, thank you. In closing, I'd like to say, if you're looking for